You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the president of Impact America, Inc. Dr. Pry has served on the Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States, established by the U.S. Congress 08-09, as director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum and advisory body to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction 05-09, on the Commission to assess the threat to the United States from electromagnetic pulse attack EMP, also commonly known as the EMP Commission, established by the U.S. Congress 01-08, as professional staff on the House Armed Services Committee of the U.S. Congress with portfolios in nuclear strategy, WMD, Russia, China, NATO, the Middle East, intelligence, and terrorism 95-01, as an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy and operational plans 85-95, where he was formally recognized by the agency for his expertise, groundbreaking research, and his outstanding accomplishments during his 10 years of service, and as a verification analyst at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency responsible for assessing Soviet compliance with nuclear and strategic forces arms control treaties 84-85. Dr. Pry also played a key role running hearings in Congress that warned about how terrorists and rogue states could pose an EMP threat, establishing the Congressional EMP Commission, helping the commission develop plans to protect the United States from EMP, and working closely with senior scientists who first discovered the nuclear EMP phenomenon. Dr. Pry holds two PhDs in international relations and U.S. history, and a certificate in nuclear weapons design from the U.S. Air Force Weapons Laboratory. He has also written numerous books on national security issues. Dr. Pry, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk to your audience about EMP.
Dr. Pry, I'm looking at your website, impactamerica.org. That's EMPACTAmerica.org. For the benefit of our listeners who might not be so familiar with this term EMP, could you explain to them exactly what it is? What is EMP?
Sure. An electromagnetic pulse is a super energetic radio wave. It can be generated by a nuclear weapon that's detonated at very high altitude, above an altitude of 30 kilometers, basically in outer space. And there's so much energy in this radio wave that it will short out electronic systems, destroy electronic systems across a broad area, basically from the point of burst of the nuclear weapon to the horizon. So if you were to detonate a nuclear weapon launched from a vessel off the coast of the United States, let's say, at an altitude of 30 or 40 kilometers, you could cover with EMP an area the size of New England, New York State, and about half of Pennsylvania, and it would destroy and disrupt all the electronics within that region, and actually beyond the EMP footprint, because the power grid across the whole country would probably collapse. And if you wanted to actually put the footprint down across the whole country, if you detonated a weapon at about altitude of about 400 kilometers over the center of the United States, you'd put an EMP footprint down that would cover not only the whole contiguous 48 states, but large parts of Canada and Mexico as well, if you just wanted to be absolutely sure about getting everything. This threat can be generated by the sun as well, and this is a relatively recent discovery, and it was first found out about by the EMP Commission. The sun generates solar flares and coronal mass ejections that can strike the Earth's magnetosphere, and they will generate an EMP very similar to that you can get from a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
These are common and happen every year at nations at high northern latitudes. They rarely happen so that they affect the United States. There was a coronal mass ejection that caused a geomagnetic storm in 1989 that took down the electric grid in Quebec. But what the commission found out was that there is the equivalent of a space hurricane that happens every now and again, where you have a very energetic solar flare or coronal mass ejection that will hit the Earth maybe every 100 years or so. We'll have what's called a great geomagnetic storm. The last of these was in 1859, and it was called the Carrington Event. And this is just when the electronic age was just beginning. We had laid the transatlantic cable for telegraphs, and there were telegraph stations. And fires broke out in telegraph stations, and the telegraph lines were burned out. The transatlantic cable was destroyed by this great geomagnetic storm. People at the time didn't realize what was happening, but we know that these things occur every century or so because they have signs that are unmistakable, and people write about them in their diaries. For example, the Aurora Borealis will show up on the equator, and it's so bright that at night you could actually read newspapers by it, created by the Carrington Event. So people will note that in their diaries. Now, we're about 50 years overdue for one of these things. Periods of increased solar flare activity, many scientists believe the likelihood goes up, logically, for a great geomagnetic storm. And every 11 years, the sun goes through what's called the solar maximum, where it's putting out an extraordinarily large number of solar flares. And that solar maximum is about to begin. It'll begin on December 2012 and go through the year 2013. So there's a lot of concern because we're overdue for one of these great geomagnetic storms. A lot of people are very concerned, including the Obama White House, that we might get hit with one of these things. And the effects can be planetary. If a Carrington event happened today, it would take down electric grids across the whole planet.
It's not something in science fiction books, you're saying.
Not only can it happen, the judgment of the scientific community is that it's inevitable. It will happen. We just don't know when. There's concern because of this thing being half a century overdue that it probably will happen sometime in the near future. These views, by the way, are among the most well-substantiated in terms of scientific research and analysis. And this is not just an inconvenience, either a nuclear EMP or a natural EMP. This is a life-threatening event because people's lives depend upon the electric critical infrastructures, electric power, water, food, banking and finance, economy, transportation, communications. All these things depend on electronics. The only reason we're able to support 310 million Americans in this country today, when less than 2% of our population are farmers, is because of technology. And all that technology is directly or indirectly dependent upon electronics. The EMP Commission estimated, given our current state of unpreparedness, within a year after an EMP event, we would probably lose about two-thirds of our population, 200 million people, because the number of people will have to reduce so that it can be sustained by what the land can carry. The final source of an EMP threat, there are non-nuclear EMP devices, typically called radio frequency weapons, and these can actually be purchased by anyone. There's advertisements for these things called EMP simulators, and they're supposed to be designed so that you can have a portable EMP generation device so you can test the hardness of equipment against EMP. But if a terrorist or a criminal or an insane person were to purchase one of these things, it could be used to make an attack. It doesn't have the range that the sun had. I mean, you couldn't take down a whole continent with this or a whole planet. They have very limited range. But if you knew what you were doing and you knew how to position the device correctly, you could probably black out a whole city and cause massive chaos and disruption. So those are the three sources of EMP threat. And as I said, what an EMP is basically a super energetic radio wave. Perhaps another way of understanding it in terms of the actual physics, anybody who has ever started a lawnmower has actually generated an EMP. When you pull on that cord on the lawnmower, You're spinning magnets around. And in effect, that's how you generate an EMP. Physics 101, a moving magnetic field will generate a current in wires exposed to that moving magnetic field. And so when you pull on the cord on your lawnmower, you're spinning a magneto, a bunch of magnets, that creates a moving magnetic field that generates electric current in the coil surrounding it, and that gets the spark that starts your lawnmower going. So exactly the same principle, except it's on a planetary scale when you're talking about nuclear weapons or natural EMP.
Right. So if we see a bunch of terrorists or criminals or insane people or all of the above make for Home Depot and Lowe's to buy a bunch of lawnmowers, we're in trouble. That's just a little joke.
Actually, it's a good observation because Before 9/11, the Congress had a special panel. It was a special panel on terrorism. The congressman who the chair, prescient guy, Jim Saxton was his name. He was the chairman of that committee. He was very concerned that terrorists were going to attack us. This was before 9/11, mind you. Mm-hmm. And he managed to convince his colleagues it should have been a subcommittee, which is a much more prestigious body. And It is now. They immediately made it into a subcommittee after the 9/11 attacks. But before the 9/11 attacks, he worked very hard and managed to get a panel on terrorism. And I worked for him on that panel, and we did an experiment. He was concerned about the EMP threat as well. And we basically hired a guy who had a master's degree in electrical engineering, gave him a couple of students and a modest budget and 1 year. And his mission was using design information available publicly on the internet and only parts that could be purchased at Radio Shack to see if he could come up with a radio frequency weapon that could do some serious damage. And he did. He came up with two of them. One of them was designed to fit inside of a Volkswagen bus. The idea was you drive it down Wall Street and cause massive economic disruption by messing up the computers on Wall Street. And the other was designed to look like a Xerox machine, and it fit inside of a shipping crate for a Xerox machine. And again, mind you, this was before 9/11. And the idea here was that you mail it to the Pentagon, and it'll just sit there. Typically, back in those days, they wouldn't inspect things. Stuff would come in, and the Pentagon would leave it in the mailroom, unclaimed, but it could be there for weeks or months. And while it was sitting there, it would just slowly burn all the computers out in the Pentagon, and people wouldn't know what was happening. So your observation about being concerned if people are running out, you know, they could actually do that. Terrorists or criminals could improvise a radio frequency weapon that could be very devastating, just purchasing stuff that's available at Radio Shack. You had mentioned the EMP Commission, for example, on which I served for 10 years. Perhaps it would help your audience to understand a little bit about what a commission is. Even a lot of policymakers don't understand the importance of these commissions.
That would be great.
When there's an issue of scientific and or strategic controversy that can't be resolved within the defense and intelligence communities, typically what's done is a commission is set up, either by the president or by the Congress, and they staff it with the best experts that are available in the free world to do this. And this was the case with our commission, for example. It was chaired by Dr. William Graham, who had been President Reagan's science advisor and the administrator of NASA, and he was literally the free world's foremost expert on EMP. Among the scientists who discovered the EMP phenomena when we stumbled upon it during a nuclear weapons test called Starfish Prime in 1962. They lit it off at high altitude just to see what it was going to do, and it knocked the lights out in the Hawaiian Islands about 900 miles away. And they didn't know why that had happened, and so Graham was called in. He was then a young U.S. Army defense scientist, and it was one of his first jobs to work on figuring out what happened, and it turned out to be EMP. Dr. John Foster was another one of the commissioners. This guy is the free world's foremost nuclear weapons designer. He's designed all the nuclear weapons that are in our current inventory. And there were other equally prestigious commissioners. But aside from the commission itself, under the law, like all commissions, since it's an arm of Congress, it had the power to task the entire defense and entire intelligence community. They had to provide all data. They had to do research. Anything the commission wanted to investigate the issue so that we could come to a consensus judgment about the threat. And the commission worked on this caliber of people, this level of power and resources, basically all the power and resources of the U.S. government worked on this issue for 10 years and came to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, terrorists and rogue states could make a nuclear EMP attack on the United States. In addition to that, they came up with this threat that they hadn't even been tasked to discover because nobody knew about the Great Geomagnetic Storm. The commission discovered that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after the commission did its work, and typically, it only takes the judgment of a single commission, because these things are usually so well-respected. The reason you staff it with senior people like that is so that you'll have a direction for policymakers to set end the controversy, and now you've got a way forward to do something about the problems that the commission has come up with, follow their recommendations, basically.
Right.
And typically, that's what happens. And you can see this in the 9/11 commission. We had one commission, the 9/11 commission, and we completely reformed the intelligence community based on their recommendations. There was a commission called the Rumsfeld Commission, the who became the Secretary of Defense. Officially, it was the Commission on the Emerging Ballistic Missile Threat to the United States. And we have a national missile defense today because they predicted that we were going to need one because rogue states and third world countries were, in fact, working on ICBM. So one commission is usually enough. In the case of EMP, we have the equivalent of five commissions. The EMP commission was the first one. The discovery about the Great Geomagnetic Storm was such an important thing and seemed so extraordinary that the National Academy of Sciences did its own independent investigation of that issue and came back and said, you know, the commission is right. There is this thing called the Great Geomagnetic Storm, and we'd better follow their recommendations. Then there was a third study by the North American Electric Reliability Council that represents all the electric utilities in the United States. In conjunction with the Department of Energy, they went and investigated the issue about the Great Geomagnetic Storm and the nuclear EMP threat and the non-nuclear EMP threat. And they came back and said, we agree. All the data supports this. All three of these are serious threats. We'd better do something about it. There was an interagency report that was put together by the Federal Electric Regulatory Commission, part of the regulatory body of the U.S. government, that quizzed all the departments and agencies of the United States. This last one was in September 2010, I believe it came out. And they, again, said the EMP commission is right. We better follow the recommendations. So here you've got five commissions, or the functional equivalent of five big commissions, all saying the same thing. And yet, we're still not protected against EMP. And it's an uphill fight. Right now, we're struggling to get the SHIELD Act passed. It's basically the core recommendation of the commission to protect our electric grid from nuclear and natural EMP. And in fact, it'll be the third year we've tried to pass a bill to do this. Last year, we almost succeeded. It was called the GRID Act. It was supported unanimously. The only bill that was supported by every Republican and every Democrat in the House of Representatives. And they sent it over the Senate, and one senator stopped that bill and kept it from coming to a vote. We should have been in the process of getting protected right now if it weren't for that one person.
Who was that?
Well, I have to work with these people.
This isn't public information.
people probably could find out if they were to go back and read the newspapers, because there was some reporting on that person, the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources on the Senate side.
Mm-hmm.
One of those people.
What do you think was the motivation of this particular person?
I know exactly why that person did it, but I can't divulge that without identifying the person. That person has promised that it'll be different this year, but it was basically a political calculation. It was pure re-election politics.
Mm-hmm.
And combined with the fact that I don't think that that person and their staff understood the gravity of what they were doing. All of this stuff about the EMP threat, and this is one of the reasons I'm so grateful to be on your show, I mean, it's still not widely understood, not only among the public, but even among policymakers who are supposed to be responsible for these things. Despite the fact that the commission has testified and the information has been around a while, it hasn't been around that long. Most information about EMP, we knew about it all through the Cold War, but it was heavily classified. Oh, there'd be a mention of EMP every now and then. I even wrote a book during the Cold War that mentioned it. But even among those of us who worked in nuclear strategy, it was a subspecialty, really well understood, only by a very eclectic group of defense scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the Pentagon today, that's the situation. And that's part of the reason we're having such a problem getting bills passed, because there's no big constituency for this. The people who understand it care about it, but there's not that many people who even understand it.
Right. It's not a household term, and I'm guilty of it, too. And look at me. I have a background in nuclear physics. I was on a nuclear sub in the U.S. Navy, so I wasn't very familiar with it until a colleague of mine brought an article to my attention about North Korea testing a super EMP nuke. Now, this was in the news. It's on ABCnews.com website. North Korea nears completion of electromagnetic pulse bomb. This was from March of this year. And then on another site, Newsmax.com, and this was from just a few days ago, North Korea tests super EMP nuke. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
Absolutely we should be concerned about. And the commission tried to draw this to people's attention back in 2005. I actually gave the interview for one of those articles that you cited.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that such an important fact coming from a person who served on this commission, because that's not my view, that's the view of the EMP commission. You'd think that that would draw some press attention, that my phone would be ringing off the hook.
Right.
You know, you're the only person who's called me. Isn't that incredible?
No, actually, it's not incredible, and I would have thought in the past that it was incredible, but from my many years of analyzing the mainstream media, I found that it's actually the opposite of incredible. The mainstream media actually does move in lockstep.
Well, you're absolutely right. This must be a politically incorrect view by their calculations. They don't want to embarrass the Obama administration and put pressure on them to do something about North Korea, I guess. I don't know what their thinking is, but for some reason, they're not interested in this. We tried as a commission to break the story,
right,
because it was in my open testimony when I testified to the Senate back in 2005, 6 years ago.
Right.
And only now has someone finally noticed and starting to pay attention to the fact that the North Koreans probably have got a super EMP weapon. Perhaps I should give a little background on that.
That would be great.
Back in 2004, the commission was a bit surprised that it got a request from a delegation of high-ranking Russian generals who were also scientists, and they happened to be Russia's foremost EMP experts. They wanted to meet with the commission and talk with us about something. So we met with them, and in this meeting, they disclosed that they had developed what they called a super EMP weapon. And this was a nuclear weapon of special design that was specifically tuned to create extraordinarily high EMP fields. And the point of this weapon, they had been developing it toward the end of the Cold War, was the idea was that you could win a nuclear war with just one weapon, because the EMP fields from this thing are so intense. And I can say this because it's in open source writings. The Russians claim it could generate 200 kilovolts per meter. That's 200,000 volts per meter. So for every meter of dimension you have, whether it's on a cable or an automobile, say your car is 4 meters long, so you multiply 200,000 volts by four. So that's 800,000 volts that's going into the car. So you can imagine when you've got communications lines that run on for kilometers, how much voltage you've got. Anyway, you get such tremendously powerful pulse out of this that it would fry even hardened strategic communication systems and weapon systems. And the idea was with one weapon, you could paralyze the other side and basically win the war with a single blow, with a single weapon. That was their theory anyway. Then the Cold War ended, but in their open source writings, they actually publicly advertised that they've got this super EMP bomb. The Chinese claim to have it as well. And we, in fact, as a commission, judged that these aren't just claims, they actually do have them, because the designs they're talking about are very plausible, and there's other reasons that we can't get into here, but we believe those judgments are true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they told us was most alarming was that during the period of Russia's economic crisis, and actually there's still economic problems, but that there had been brain drain from Russia. Russian scientists who knew the secret of the super EMP weapon had gone to work for the North Koreans. And the North Koreans were also, according to these guys, getting help from the Chinese and Pakistanis, too, on their nuclear weapons project, and that they were working on the super. They warned, this was in 2004, mind you, that because it's not that hard to develop a super EMP weapon, that within a few years, as they put it, that's an exact quote, within a few years, North Korea could get a super EMP bomb. And they wanted to warn the United States because they thought that a North Korea armed with a super EMP nuclear weapon would pose a threat to global civilization. And perhaps we should do something about that. A few years after they gave that warning, North Korea had its first nuclear test in 2006. And a lot of people who don't know what they're talking about, especially in the press, declared that that first test was a failure. Why did they do that? Because the seismic signal was very weak. It only had a 1 to 3 kiloton yield. The widespread assumption was that the first North Korean bomb was going to be a first-generation nuclear weapon, like a Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb. It should have generated 10 kilotons or something like that in that neighborhood. But if you were looking at a super EMP weapon, its seismic signature looked exactly like what a super should, because the super EMP weapon is not about creating a big explosion. What it's doing is it's converting the energy from the bomb into gamma radiation, and that's what causes the EMP phenomenon, so that you'd expect a weapon that has a very low yield, basically a fizzle. In fact, that's how it was described in terms of the seismic test. You get this low yield and it's a fizzle. And the fizzle is the gammas coming out. And then they tested it again in 2009. Same thing. And the press again declared, oh, the weapon was a failure. They're not having luck with their program. But it looked exactly like the earlier test. And the North Koreans declared it publicly assessed. And the commission judged that the North Koreans may well have the super. South Korean military intelligence, independently of the commission, has put out a couple of press reports. I think one was in 2009. The second report was actually earlier this year, warning that Russian scientists are working in North Korea on a super EMP bomb. And the South Koreans judged that the North Koreans were far enough along so that they were on the verge of deploying the super. If you want to know what North Korea is doing, there are a few better sources of intelligence than South Korea. Just like if you want to know what the Arabs are up to, you go talk to Mossad. Want to know what Red China's up to? Talk to the Taiwanese intelligence people. Because they're just focused like a laser on that potential adversary. And the same thing is true of South Korea military intelligence when it comes to North Korea. So they independently arrived at exactly the same conclusion that the EMP Commission did about the North having the super and being on the verge of getting the super. You don't have to be a nuclear weapons designer. I mean, just sort of common sense reasons why people, if you just think about it a little bit, would say, well, you know, it's entirely plausible that they could come up with an advanced nuclear weapon like that. Why do I say that? Well, let's look at the U.S. experience at coming up with nuclear weapons, the Manhattan Project. When we were working with 1930s era technology and nobody knew that nuclear weapons were even possible, they were just a theory. It only took us 3 years to come up with two atomic bombs, both of completely different designs, one an implosion device, the other a gun device, and they both worked. And we didn't even test the Hiroshima bomb. We took that thing right out of the laboratory and it worked. The Nagasaki bomb was tested only once, and it worked. So why do we assume that North Korea, getting help from the Russians, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, they've been working on this since 1995 and before, actually, but we estimated that they had probably come up with their first bomb back in 95, and obviously their program went back further than that, so they've been working on it for decades. So shouldn't they be able to at least duplicate what the United States did in World War II using modern technology and with all this extra help that they're getting? Indeed, one would think that if they're putting so much more time and effort into it than we did, that they might come up with something that's a little bit better than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, right? We also have the example of Israel, which has never tested a nuclear weapon to our knowledge.
Well, they don't have one, right? Yeah.
We know from the Vanunu defection, Mordecai Vanunu, who came out with photographs of their Dimona complex, that not only do they have probably about 200 nuclear weapons, but they're extremely advanced nuclear weapons. They include thermonuclear weapons, they've got neutron bombs that can be launched by artillery and missile, and they're never even tested. In Israel, it has a population the size of Baltimore, and it doesn't have anything like the resources that a country like Iran has, for example. That doesn't have their oil wealth, and by the way, the Iranians have been working with the North Koreans. A lot of the money for the North Korean program is probably coming from Iran, and we know there have been Iranian scientists present at both North Korean tests. And a final point I would make, we also know that recently, South Korean military intelligence and Defense Intelligence Agency, a couple of weeks ago, in testimony to the Senate, said that North Korea has now miniaturized warheads for its missiles. So it has actually deployed nuclear warheads on missiles. Now, does it make any sense at all that if North Korea had not been successful in its tests, that it would now be deploying warheads on missiles that haven't worked? I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. If it were true, these assertions that the North Korean tests were failures, which is the common view, that's the mainstream media view,
right?
The idea that they would have moved forward to the next step and they would have taken these failed physics packages and gone to the trouble to miniaturize them so they could turn them into missile warheads, I mean, it makes no sense at all. At some point, the mainstream media is going to have to start catching up with reality, because I think the commission is clearly right about this when you look at all the data and when you look at our historic experience and the experience of other countries, that indeed, we'd better start facing up to the fact that North Korea not only has a working nuclear weapon, but it's probably an advanced nuclear weapon. It is probably a super EMP weapon. Not that they would need a super EMP weapon to take us out as a society, even a crude first-generation weapon detonated at altitude, as I said. Because our civilian critical infrastructures are unprotected, just completely unprotected, they could take us out then anyway. But if you had the super, it would also enable you to take out all the military systems, and it would greatly increase your confidence. It would make the rubble bounce, as it were, in EMP terms. And it's always nice to know that you've got the ability not just to kill your enemy. There is a certain comfort factor in knowing you can kill him 10 times over and have that confidence. And that's what the super would do for you. Now, this was not a commission judgment, but it's sort of a common sense thing, I think, that flows if you can continue down this road, the logic of it. You know, since Iranians were present at these North Korean tests, and since Iran wants the bomb and has probably been funding the North Korean program, and since North Korea will sell anything to anyone, we also have to be concerned that Iran not only might get the super, maybe they already have it, and we just don't know about it. Our intelligence on the Iranian nuclear program is terrible. We do know North Koreans are in Iran and are working on their missile program, at least. In fact, the best Iranian missile, the Shahab-3, which is a medium-range ballistic missile, is really nothing but a souped-up North Korean Nodong. They bought Nodongs from the North Koreans. They renamed them the Shahab-3, and they got help from the North Koreans, the Russians, and the Chinese to soup them up a little bit so that they perform a little bit better than the Nodong. But basically, they're a North Korean missile that was sold to Iran in violation of the missile technology control regime. And if they're selling strategic missiles to the Iranians, why not nuclear weapons? They're already a pariah state and breaking the law in every way you can.
Right. Do these EMP weapons need to be exploded in relatively close proximity to their targets?
The nuclear weapons or the non-nuclear EMP weapons?
Either one.
Well, the nuclear weapons don't have to at all. As I said before, in fact, you've got to be a minimum of 30 kilometers above the surface of the Earth in order to start getting the EMP effect for a nuclear weapon in the first place. So you're going to be very far away from your target. If you were to light off a nuclear weapon at 400 kilometers, most Americans would be completely unaware that a nuclear weapon had gone off. If it was done on a cloudy day, no one would know, not even the people who are immediately beneath it, because this thing is going off 100 miles away, especially if it were a low-yield nuclear weapon like a super EMP weapon. 1 to 3 kilotons is tiny yield. If it were done at night and you were looking at the sky at exactly the right place, you'd see a little light come on and off. That's about it. The first way you'd know that we'd been attacked is the lights would go out. Your car wouldn't start. If your car doesn't start, that's probably the super EMP weapon.
Right, if your car doesn't start and your neighbor's car doesn't start at the same time, right?
Right.
How far away would the weapon have to be, the North Korean weapon have to be, from U.S. shores in order to have the EMP effect?
You could either deliver it by an ICBM, and they're working on that. That's the Taipodong 2. Everything works on the Taipodong 2 except that last stage. That's having problems with the third stage, but they're very close to getting that ICBM to work. The other way you could do it, the smarter way to do it, the way the Iranians have actually practiced doing it, is to launch a missile off a ship. You know, use a Scud missile or the Shahab-3, which is basically Scud missile technology too. And the reason it would be smart to use a Scud or Shahab-3 using Scud technology is that more than 60 countries in the world own Scuds, and terrorists have them. Terrorists in Yemen have got Scud missiles, and even private collectors have got Scuds. So that way it keeps your fingerprints off of it. You're using a missile system, a technology that is very widespread. So the missile isn't coming off your country, it's coming off a freighter. It could be a freighter under a false flag, a container ship or something like that. You do special forces. The Shahab-3 has got a range of about 1,500 kilometers. If you were firing from the Gulf Coast, you could be outside of our territorial waters and get that thing up to enough altitude so you'd be able to cover the whole United States with an EMP attack.
So it's something that definitely is plausible even today, because that's 1,000 miles away. So, gotcha. Now, the SHIELD Act, you mentioned that before.
Yeah, the SHIELD Act was introduced in the House by Congressman Trent Franks, and it's H.R. 668. It stands for the Secure High Voltage Infrastructure for Electricity Lethal Damage Act.
So it's the Secure High Voltage Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
For electricity. from Lethal Damage Act.
Gotcha, and that's H.R. 668. Okay. And it seems like from what we said earlier, the SHIELD Act has a great possibility to pass, right?
Well, it had a better possibility to pass at the beginning of the year. But yeah, we were hoping that it would pass unanimously, the way the GRID Act did last year, because all Republicans in the House were all good soldiers on this. They all understood that we face a clear and present danger, and they unanimously supported the GRID Act. And people expected that when the Republicans took over the House, and we basically reintroduced a very similar act. The SHIELD Act is very similar to the GRID Act. It's not exactly the same as the GRID Act. It's got some important differences. The GRID Act, for example, was more ambiguous about protecting against nuclear EMP, whereas the SHIELD Act is very strong on that and very explicit about it. For some reason, I think because of the Democrat-liberal base, they're much more enthusiastic about protecting against the natural EMP from the sun. But when you start talking about nuclear EMP, they have such an allergy to nuclear weapons and nuclear scenarios that I think that their political base objected to being so explicit. You could have used the bill to protect against nuclear EMP. It didn't exclude that possibility. In my opinion, you're running a real risk if you don't declare very clearly in the bill language that you're not supposed to protect just against natural EMP and just against non-nuclear EMP weapons, but nuclear EMP weapons are also included. In fact, that's absolutely crucial, because if you protect against natural EMP and non-nuclear EMP, you're actually not protected, because the waveform from a nuclear EMP weapon, it is more destructive than the other two alternatives. And if we got hit with a nuclear EMP attack, despite the fact that you spent all that money and resources protecting against the other threats, the system would still go down. On the other hand, if you protect against the nuclear EMP threat, you protect it against all the EMP threats. And it doesn't cost anymore. It would actually be more expensive if you made the mistake that I think the GRID Act was leading us into, which is industry has to protect against the natural EMP and then the non-nuclear EMP. And then they go ahead and do that. And we have a long legal battle over, well, does the GRID Act really require you to protect against nuclear EMP or not? Because you know that's what's going to happen. The industry lobbyists will say, it's not in the bill. You haven't explicitly said so. And eventually Congress may be able to prevail and win in the courts. A lot of time will have passed. Then industry, if we win, would be forced to go back and retrofit for nuclear EMP too. So you'll be basically going back and hardening stuff twice. And that's how you drive costs through the roof. That's not the way to do it. You get it right the first time, and that is a way of really controlling the costs and keeping the cost down. And why not protect against the most serious threat right from the get-go when it isn't going to cost you any more money? The other problem with the GRID Act versus the SHIELD Act is the GRID Act also treats cybersecurity. It gets into cyber issues. They were following the commission's recommendation because the EMP commission planned to protect the country from EMP. The way Dr. Graham did it is he wanted to take what he calls an all-hazards approach so that when we were protecting the critical infrastructures, we did it in such a way that they would be protected not just from EMP, but they'd be protected from practically anything you can imagine that could be thrown against the critical infrastructures, including cyber attacks, natural disasters, and physical sabotage. The commission actually came up with a plan for doing that that would cover all these bases. So my hat is off to the Democrats for following the commission recommendation last year and following all hazards approach by including cyber. But we then learned that the politics of Congress will not let such a bill pass. There is a very strong business and government entities that have a special interest in cyber, and they don't want their cyber bills. Over on the Senate side, for example, there's, I think, a half a dozen bills all competing with each other for cyber. And they just want a pure cyber bill. And that's one of the reasons that the GRID Act got stopped last year, because they didn't like EMP getting mixed in with cyber. And so Mr. Franks wisely removed the cyber provisions, too. So those were two big important differences between the SHIELD Act and the GRID Act. Naturally, in a perfect world, I would have preferred to be pure about following the EMP Commission's recommendations. But unfortunately, the political realities of Congress often force you to do things that don't make that much strategic sense, but you have no alternative in order to get the bill through.
Right.
And we were, in effect, we had a deal with the Senate side, with the cyber geeks on the Senate side, that if we took the cyber out, that they would support the bill. And we had that deal. And so right now, there's a battle going on the House side about which of these bills is going to prevail. Is it going to be the Democrat GRID Act or the Republican SHIELD Act? I'm hoping common sense will prevail, because if the GRID Act is the one that prevails in the House, I think the same thing will happen when it goes over to the Senate side, and it will not pass. And it also has that serious weakness in it right now. Hopefully that we're talking with the Democrats, hopefully they will modify that and make the GRID Act strong on the nuclear EMP as well. But that might not happen. So I'm disappointed to have to report that the bill is basically in trouble right now. Your listeners, though, could help out if they were to call their congressmen and senators, call all the congressmen and senators. senators, especially on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is where the battle is being fought right now, the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And that committee is chaired by Congressman Upton. If they were to call every member of that committee and say, get off your duffs and pass the SHIELD Act. We're running out of time to get the country protected. Next year is 2012. December 2012 is when the solar maximum begins. If the bill passes this year, we might just have enough time to at least protect the most important parts of the electric grid to avert a catastrophe if a great geomagnetic storm happens during the solar maximum, as many people fear it may. The FERC, much to its credit, is ready to hit the ground running to get out there and protect the critical components. Right now, they can't do it legally. The bill has got to pass in order for them to be able to do that. There's an old saying, you never want to see how sausages and laws are made.
Yeah.
And I tell you, that is true. As a person who has approached this, been in the intelligence and defense community all my life and working these from a technical angle, it is so frustrating to know that technologically we can do this. We've known for 50 years how to protect against EMP. The Department of Defense worked out the technology. It's there. It doesn't cost that much. We can do it relatively inexpensively and fast, too. And yet we've been hung up now for years. Well, why? It isn't a technological problem. It's not a problem of money. It's a problem of political will and the lawyers. The lawyers from industry, the lawyers from the Department of Homeland Security. Nobody wants to take responsibility. It's the institutional. It's the bureaucracy.
And the businesses also, like you mentioned.
Yeah, that's right. Industry will surround itself with lawyers and lobbyists,
right, sure,
because they don't want any regulation at all. And I'm a conservative Republican. Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, who's the one who actually started all this stuff about EMP, is one of the most conservative Republicans in Congress. I advise him on these things. He and I are both small government conservatives. We're not in favor of big government at all.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain minimal responsibilities the government has, and one of the most important of those is to provide for the common defense. When the lives of millions of Americans are at stake, there is a place for government to do that. So it doesn't make sense, even if you're a fundamentally anti-government person, you should be supporting this, because it is within the constitutional limits of obligations, not just limits,
right.
Constitutional fundamental obligation. If we had a tiny fraction of the money that's going to be spent on Obamacare, I think that we would do more for the health of the American people by protecting against EMP. This is a real threat. It really matters.
Right. Not just Obamacare, but these wars. Our listeners, when they go to your website, empactamerica.org, empactamerica.org, you have a couple of tabs up top, home, learn about, take action, news, media center, forum and blogs, contact, and of course there are drop-down menus on most of them, including videos that folks could listen to, and they have the board of advisors for MPACT, which of course you're the president of the organization. You have several congressmen on that board of advisors and other notable people, and the take action tab, which drops down about 6-7 items. Join MPACT America, act now, send a message, look up your representative. So you have everything there that people can do, volunteer, social media, links to us. When it says join MPACT America, now they have to give their name and address and phone number.
Yeah, that's right. We're constantly looking for volunteers. We don't take money from anybody. We're not asking for donations or anything like that. We're asking for people's time and work, people being willing to reach out and call congressmen or educate their communities about this threat. MPACT America, I should point out, it's not based in Washington. I work out of Washington. I work down on the Hill, but most of our people are in upstate New York. I didn't start this organization. It was actually started by people who were first responders and people who work in the dairy industry up there. A handful of them became aware. One of them actually read the EMP Commission reports. They become very alarmed that the government wasn't doing anything. And as Americans, as there has been a long tradition in America about doing, they decided to try to take measures in their own hands by starting a grassroots movement. They asked me to lead it, and I'm just so proud. I never thought I would ever become a guerrilla activist outside of government, but I find myself doing that. And I must say, it makes proud of our country, because for 10 years, we worked on the commission. We tried to get Congress to do something, and they didn't do anything. And then this organization has only been active for the past 2 years,
mm-hmm.
And it does make a huge difference when ordinary people call congressmen and call senators, and suddenly the people that vote care about something.
Right.
And we've gotten 3 bills. Now, we haven't passed one yet, but in 2 years, MPACT America has come closer to being able to get the country protected than the EMP Commission was able to do in 10.
Wow.
Even with all those high-ranking scientists and highly respected figures and all of that, it's taken rakes and pitchforks from the people to basically
right.
tell Congress to get off its big fat A and do
right.
something. It actually works. It shows the system is working. I don't know if it'll work in time. We're running out of time. But it does make you feel good to see that, gee, democracy might actually work. And one of the things that we've taken it here at Impact America is sort of a different philosophy that I think is consistent with the times where people are so disgusted with government, and especially Washington.
Sure.
Impact America doesn't think all of the solution should come out of Washington. Now, a lot of our efforts are to try to get Washington to do the right thing, but more of our effort is actually based on educating individuals and communities on what they can do personally to prepare for an EMP or any kind of a nationwide catastrophe so that they would be able to survive. Because I think when the government fails to do its job, we are our own first line of defense for ourselves and for our families. All leadership doesn't have to come out of Washington. Historically, we can lead from the bottom up. For example, National Missile Defense, popular movement for National Missile Defense, actually played a very important role in us finally getting the National Missile Defense. It wasn't just the commission, the Rumsfeld Commission. There was a lot of popular support for doing that because it made sense to the American people. When we lead from the bottom up and take steps in our own communities and our own personal lives, the Washington bureaucrats, I think, will notice that. And they always like to pretend that they're out leading the parade, so that will help move them to take action. Besides which, people should take individual responsibility for their families and communities and be prepared and shouldn't be so trusting that government is going to come to the rescue. How many times have we been disappointed, even against hurricanes? Look at Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina. Does anybody really believe that the feds are 1,000% better now in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina? They're not. If you go back to the Government Accountability Office reports, I've actually just finished the first draft of the new book, and I was looking through the record through the Government Accountability Reports. This is the GAO. It's an investigative arm of Congress that
Sure.
sees how well government does its job. And there's a long history, going back before Hurricane Andrew, of every time the government failing to come to the rescue of the people, it always turns out to be a disaster. The GAO would make recommendations about what they could do to fix the problem, and they never acted on those recommendations. And in fact, there are current GAO reports that they're not following up on all the failings that caused Katrina. You just can't trust the feds to be competent, to be efficient. The Department of Homeland Security is promising people, oh, all you have to do is be self-sufficient for 72 hours, and then Uncle Sam is going to be there and take care of everything. Don't believe that. That's not going to happen, especially after an EMP. They don't even have EMP as one of their canonical 15 national emergency planning scenarios. Their emergency planning scenarios, if you go and look at them, they're unclassified. They're all the same scenario. They're all some small, local disaster that DHS can manage with its existing resources. You know, they just change the name, but it's always the same thing. It affects a city, it affects maybe a couple of towns. The rest of the country is intact and all the infrastructure works so they can come in and overwhelm the problem. That's not going to be the situation in an EMP event.
No, but the media seems to be concentrating more on the Mayan calendar than the EMP event. Perhaps if some screenwriter put together a nice script and Hollywood bought it and made a movie about EMP, it would attract a lot more attention, obviously, because as you said, this press that came out just a couple of days ago, last week, about the North Korean super EMP weapon, nobody has contacted you, not one person from the press except me.
That's correct.
How does Impact America survive financially?
We have a founder. The guy's name is Mr. Henry Schwartz. He's a patriotic American. He's the CEO of Steben Foods. And he was one of those who first read the EMP Commission reports and became alarmed about that. And as a matter of principle, he doesn't want our organization to be accused of doing what it's doing to make money.
Right.
He's basically funding this out of his own resources, and all the money for these things comes from him, from his personal fortune, and from the contributions of our volunteers. The only contribution we will accept is people's time. People can volunteer to work for us.
Dr. Pry, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I'd like to leave one last message with your listeners. Even if you don't want to join an organization like Impact America, I ask you to think about this. Think back to how your parents' generation, or maybe it was your grandparents' generation, were one generation removed from a tradition of rugged individualism and self-sufficiency that was the way that was normative for the way people lived in this country, whether they were Republicans or Democrats. Since the colonial era up until the great generation that lived through the Great Depression and won World War II. Even if you don't want to join an organization, think about perhaps it would benefit your life and your family's life to recapture those virtues and pass them on to your kids. My parents, they had never heard of EMP. But not only would they have been prepared for such an event, they probably would have had a good time. My parents, because they'd lived through the Great Depression and World War II, they were suspicious of government. They knew government was often a lot of hire, and you had to trust your own family and trust your own resources first, that you were your own first line of defense. We only lived on a small, we had a third of an acre, but most of it was cultivated. My mother had her own garden. She was constantly canning food. My father would tell us how he fed his family during the Great Depression by shooting woodchucks. They called them Hoover hogs. Mm-hmm. And he taught us the use of firearms when we were kids, all the survival arts, how to fish, how to hunt. As I said, if the lights got knocked out for a protracted period of time, if you know how to do all those things, not only can you survive, you might even have fun.
Right.
It makes for a different kind of society when you know that you can take care of yourself and your own family on your own and you don't need the government. I think that that kind of an attitude of people who are rugged individualists and are self-sufficient like that will be a lot less tolerant of the nanny state and a lot more jealous of the freedoms that are given to them in the Constitution. And I think that because we're losing those virtues, we're only a generation or two away from them now, but it's amazing how dependent and how few Americans really can do that anymore. And perhaps it's not a coincidence that we're so quickly becoming a socialized kind of a society, not the America I grew up in. We're in effect becoming a nanny state as these virtues depart from us. So please, even if you don't want to join Impact America, just think about that, about whether you might not be better off to live the way your father or your grandfather did and do something to protect yourself, take care of your family, to be self-sufficient, to capture that pioneer spirit of rugged individualism that is really what made this country great. Not the government, not Washington, D.C., not the politicians, but individual Americans who were strong enough to stand on their own feet. That's what being an American really is all about, strong enough to stand on your own feet.
I'm sure that a lot of our listeners feel the same way you do. I know I do. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, president of Impact America, Inc., and a great American, thank you for the time that you spent today explaining all this to our listeners, and we'll be staying on top of the SHIELD Act.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. Thank you again, and you're a great American too, sir.